Welcome everybody to Dhamma Threads, where we are going to unravel the meaning of the suttas, the meaning of the Buddha's words, to try to see what the Buddha was saying, what he was teaching, and to see how we can apply that in our lives, what meaning it has for us. Let's move on to the next clause of the sutta. Abstention from false speech is wholesome. Abstention from malicious speech is wholesome. Abstention from harsh speech is wholesome. Abstention from gossip is wholesome. So these are the four kinds of right speech. Of course, the other four kinds, the opposite of those being the four kinds of wrong speech. And these also being related to the five precepts, but being somewhat broader. I think that the purpose in the five precepts, you have the precept against false speech, because that's something which is relatively well definable and that we can keep, you know, pretty straightforwardly. Whereas with some of the other factors, it's a little bit more of a grey area, isn't it? Yeah? So I think this is perhaps why there isn't a precept as such against these things. Although we do find precepts against these things in the Vinaya for the monks and nuns, for example, against abusing and these kinds of things. But nevertheless, you know, so that we have the false speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, and gossip. So there are four different aspects of speech. And of course, when the Buddha described these things in more detail, he always would put them in a very positive sense. You know? So speech which is true, the crucial thing with speech which is true is that you are moving yourself based on wisdom and what is real. Right? And you're also moving the people that are around you towards what is true and what is real. Yeah? So you are directly undercutting delusion. And the more that you lie, the more that you're building up delusion. Yeah? And that's why lies never work. A little known fact about the Vinaya for the monks and nuns is that it's against the Vinaya to take a vow of silence. Yeah? Interesting, eh? And the Buddha was very scathing in his criticism of it, actually. He said, "How can you foolish men take a vow of silence, the practice of other religions? It is not to be done." Yeah? And the reason was because we have to live together as human beings. We live in a society, we live in a culture, we live in a community, and we have to be able to speak to each other and communicate about things that are meaningful. Yeah. That came to my mind the other day. I was in Canberra and we were doing a series of meetings with the different elected representatives of our people and to discuss the ethics of climate change and trying to help our government to be more, I guess, more considerate and compassionate for the environment and for future generations. And while we were there, we did a media thing, and they asked me to talk about the Racial Vilification Act, which, as you know, and I'm sure you're very familiar with it as lawyers, is a hot topic in Australia right at the moment. And of course, they asked me about this. I just vaguely knew the background, but I wasn't that familiar with it. And I thought to myself, should I just shut up and not say anything? Or should I say what I know? And you know, I thought about it for a minute, and I said, okay, well, I'll say something. But I just asked the reporters, please don't ask any technical questions. We'll just stick to generalities, yeah. And so I just tried to stick to the basic principle, which is that freedom of speech. Of course, the problem that they're having here, and it is an interesting problem, I think. You know, of course, we want to protect freedom of speech. Right? On the other hand, not everybody uses freedom their freedom to speak in a responsible way, and sometimes that can be used, certainly not in a kind way, sometimes in a harmful way, and so sometimes government steps in and says these kinds of speech are not legal, right? And so the question really is what boundaries should be put around speech, and what role does the government have in legislating that? So the current government wants to abolish essentially the restrictions on hate speech and racial vilification and so on. Now, the exact legal details I'm not that familiar with, but you know, I do think that there's an important principle here. We have had some cases in Australia of very, very hateful speech, and it can be extremely harmful. And I personally don't think that just anything should be allowed. I think there should be some limits. But how we handle those limits, I think, needs to be treated with a great deal of care. There was, I read a very interesting article, a couple of articles actually, where the bullies, is that the right word? The persons who have been bullied have met the bullier. Yeah, and so there have been a couple of cases where they've traced down, because all these people, of course, hide behind their internet anonymity, supposedly, or hide behind the illusion of anonymity on the internet, make all these kind of comments. There's some very interesting articles where they just arranged, they found the person, they said, you know, confirmed that it was them, and then they said, look, we just want to meet and talk. And so they just arranged to have a cup of coffee with the person who did the bullying, you know. And, of course, what you find out is that usually the people doing that stuff are perfectly kind of normal people a lot of the time. I mean, sometimes they're not. And this is one thing which we also have to remember, is that a lot of the most extreme statements you find on the internet are actually by people who have mental disabilities. Right, who often can't speak in a normal context with friends and things because they don't have any. Yeah, and so they use what avenues they have, and they express these crazy things because they're crazy. And so we have to have a little bit of compassion about that when we see things like that on the web. Just remember, this is quite possibly a person with serious problems. But in other cases, that's not the case. And in many cases, someone may be quite normal. And, you know, so, and usually they're young, often men, I think, and they're, you know, this guy was, he was like an 18-year-old guy, was maybe a bit younger, 16 or something like that, and he's meeting it, he's like, oh, it was just a bit of fun.
Yeah.
You know, he was just messing around.
Going through his paces.
And no conception, and there's a complete lack of compassion, right? No conception of the actual suffering that's been caused on the other side, yeah. And I know one of the, you know, there's been a lot of very serious examples of that, but a lot directed towards women in particular. And the misogyny online and a lot of these things is really terrible. And, you know, a lot of women who've spoken up on women's issues and so on who got trolled very badly. And what do you do? You know, you say, well, you know, it's just on the internet. It doesn't exist in real life. So what do you do? Well, I'll just close my email and my Facebook and my Twitter and so on and so forth. And so I don't actually communicate with my friends anymore because I can't. And it actually can be a big, very, very traumatic. As you said, at its worst, even leading to suicide. Yeah. An important characteristic of right speech is that it be articulate. And this is something that I find as a monk is often, I try to express myself as clearly as I can because I'm trying to communicate the Dhamma. So I always try to bear that in mind. It's my, the words that I'm saying, any wisdom that might be in there is not my wisdom, it's the Buddha's wisdom. And so I'm here to serve the Dhamma and to serve the wisdom of the Buddha as best as I can. And so I have this obligation to try to express that in a way which is clear and comprehensible. Firstly, right, this is the first thing, is at least be clear and comprehensible. If it might be moving or enjoyable or something, then that's added extra. But at the minimum, we can at least articulate it well. And I think this is, again, something which can happen when we overemphasize on the passive and the quiet aspects of things, that we don't learn to actually, how do we place our voice in a public sphere in a meaningful way? Yeah? We've never learned actually how do you act like that example you just said, to be assertive and to state your case without getting angry and so on. And that's a skill. It's not something that just happens, right? And it only comes because you trial and error, like any skill. You just have to do it, fail, do it again, fail again, keep on going, and eventually you figure out what's the right way to do that. So we've been discussing the first section of the sutta, which talks about the wholesome and the unwholesome, the kusala and the akusala, using the framework of the 10 ways of wholesome action, the dasa kusala kama pata. And so we've discussed so far the three factors dealing with physical action, that's abstaining from killing, from stealing, and from sexual misconduct. And we've also discussed the four factors dealing with speech, that's abstaining from false speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, and gossip. And we've now come to discuss the final three factors, which are mental factors, which is uncovetousness, okay, abhijja, lack of abhijja, non-ill will, and right view, all of these wholesome factors. And so these, of course, opposed to the unwholesome factors, which are their opposites. Now, in these particular terms, we can see that there's obviously a pattern here, right? So the covetousness is a form of greed, right? Ill will, obviously, is anger. And wrong view is obviously delusion. Yeah. So here we have that very basic triad in Buddhism of greed, hatred, and delusion. But the particular forms that they are phrased in here is meaningful. Like, it's not, it doesn't just say greed, hatred, and delusion, right? But it's phrased in terms of, it's a little bit more specific, right? And these three terms, in fact, refer primarily to strong forms of greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay, not to all of them, and so covetousness is defined literally as covetousness, literally as wishing, looking at what somebody else has got and wishing, thinking, oh, really wish I could have one of them, you know. And similarly, you know, anger is described in quite strong terms, and delusion is described in terms of wrong view. So this is like wrong view is a form of very persistent and strong kind of ignorance, right, and or delusion. So these 10 pathways of wholesome and unwholesome action are mainly, because they're kamma, right? Because they're kamma, it's mainly concerned with what is within the round of samsara. Okay? And so, yes, it has that transcendental aspect, and it is leading to nibbana as well. But the word kamma is always used in Buddhism or in early Buddhism to mean those actions which are within that round of samsara, right? So it's good actions and bad actions and so on. And so to realize enlightenment, of course, is to realize the ending of kamma, right? So someone who's enlightened will obviously be able to do these wholesome deeds, but they won't be making any kamma because of that, right? So within the sphere of this, so what we're looking at most directly here is those forms of greed, hatred, and delusion which emerge in quite strong or definite unwholesome acts. Yeah? And this is what we mean by covetousness, ill will, and wrong view. Let's move on to the last of these mental factors is wrong view. Okay, so we recognize wrong view, we let go, and we develop right view. So what's wrong view and right view? Just to give a bit of a technical explanation, but the word that we're translating as view here is the Pali word ditthi, and ditthi is related to the word to see, which is why we translate it as view, but it actually has a very similar connotation to the English word view. It's actually quite a good translation. Sometimes it's translated as right effort or wrong, sorry, right, right understanding or wrong understanding, but I think that's an incorrect translation. What we're talking about here is what's your opinion? What's the way that you see things? And that's the whole theme of this sutta. So, of course, we have many opinions about different kinds of things, right? And I'm somebody who's accused sometimes of having strong opinions, right? And it seems like in the Buddhist world, to say somebody has strong opinions is by itself a valid criticism. And I less frequently encounter people who say you have well-informed views or reflective views or ones which are coherent or anything like that. But simply that doesn't seem to be relevant, right? Whether they're intelligent, reflective, well-informed or good views or right views doesn't seem to be relevant. What's relevant, whether they're strong or not. And so sometimes there seems to be an idea within the Buddhist community, some parts of the Buddhist community, a bit similar to the thing with right speech, that sometimes it's better just to have no views at all. So at least you don't get in any arguments with anybody. And as usual, of course, there's always a sutta that addresses that particular issue. And this is the Diganaka Sutta, where the wanderer comes to the Buddha and says, nothing whatsoever is pleasing to me. I don't accept anything at all, is literally what he says. Right? I don't accept anything at all. And so the Buddha says, well, that view of yours, do you accept that? So, of course, he was immediately defeated, right? Yeah. There only took one question by the Buddha and then he's gone, yeah. So this is this idea that we can have no views. But, of course, you have to have views, right? That's how the human mind works, right? We have views about things. Yeah, there's no, we don't have a choice in that. If we go around saying that we don't have any views, all that shows is you have a massive denial about what the views that you have and a complete lack of understanding of how the human mind works, right? You have to have views, and the views will give you an orientation, and then you perceive that. Now, we know from, for example, in science, that, you know, the question of views is handled quite consciously there. You have like a hypothesis, which is a view, and then you go and you test that hypothesis, and you get some results, and then you review it, and you say, do these results confirm the hypothesis or not? And if they confirm it, then you can accept that. If they refute it, then you abandon it. And then if you take a sufficiently kind of broad hypothesis, which has been tested by enough experiments and so on, then you can call that a theory, right? And so a scientific theory is essentially a well-established and major sort of paradigm of a view, whereas a hypothesis is more kind of a sort of local specific view in one particular case. And so it's built into science that you have to keep on testing your views. Huh? And I would suggest that we have a similar situation in Buddhism, where, you know, it's built in right from the fabric of Buddhism that we should always be testing what these views are. We should be treating them as hypotheses which are subject to inquiry and subject to the evidence and subject to testing. And there's many things which we find in the suttas which turned out to be wrong, right? It talks about Mount Meru, which is supposed to be 84,000 yojanas high. There aren't any mountains that big. The 84,000 yojanas is like halfway to the moon or something. And it talks about animals in the ocean that are like 20,000 miles long or something like that. Well, there are very big animals in the ocean, but they're not quite that big. And so on. So there are some things in there you find that are not actually accurate. But of course, all of those things are more or less trivial, right? They're not things that really matter for the Dhamma itself. But of course, there are other things which are more central to the Dhamma, which also can be questioned and should be questioned. And one of the ones which comes up most often is the question of rebirth. Huh? Mm. And this is one of the main things which is mentioned when the Buddha talks about right views. Is he talks about whether you believe in rebirth, karma, and the results of karma. And, of course, this is something which is quite controversial these days. Of course, in many respects, as I said, Buddhism has many similarities to science, but it's a bit hard to say what scientists believe, all different kinds of things, but the sort of main underlying assumptions in science tend to be materialist assumptions, and they typically don't accept the idea of rebirth. So this is one area where Buddhism perhaps is different. And so it's an area where we have to be open-minded and have to be ready to question and inquire. Don't just insist that something must be true because it says so in the suttas, but you take it up, you investigate it, and you say, okay, does this match up with reality? And, the Buddha was never about trying to bash his views into people's heads, right? He was about always asking, Tanking Manyata Bhikkhave, what do you think, Max? Right? Getting you to reflect about it, trying to understand. So the right view has really two aspects to it. One aspect is what's the content of right view, right? So it's like the Four Noble Truths and the understanding of karma and rebirth and the principles of the Dhamma and so on. But what's equally important, if not more important, is the process of right view. And that's the process of inquiry, investigation, reflection. All these words, you find so many words that mean those kinds of ideas in Pali. We monks are pachavekana, patisankha, anupassana, vichara, and so on and so on. There's many, many words all talking about this process of reflection, inquiry, investigation. And so, you know, to be honest, I'm much happier with somebody who says, I don't believe in Buddhism because I've looked at all the evidence and I don't believe in rebirth because I've looked at all the evidence and I don't think it adds up. I think someone like that is much more better on the path than somebody who just blindly believes something because that's what they've been told to believe since they've grown up, you know? There's a saying I once read that they have in Hinduism that somebody who loves God will be enlightened in 7 lifetimes, and someone who hates God will be enlightened in 3. Yeah? And there's a very, very profound truth in that, yeah? I think so. You know, if you look at a lot of these questions, and people, even if they bring that critical mind to thinking about it, at least they're thinking about it. Right? Whereas a lot of people, they just sort of drift on their lives, oh yeah, that's how it is, and you don't even investigate or inquire. So to me, that's the most important thing with the right view, is to awaken that inquiring mind. Okay, so we've discussed all of the individual 10 factors of the Dasakusala Kammapatta, the 10 pathways of wholesome or skillful action. And so all that remains now is just to look a bit at the structure of the passage and how it works. After talking about the 10 ways of good action and bad action, the Buddha then talks about the roots. So after talking about the unwholesome, he says, what's the root of the unwholesome? Greed is the root of the unwholesome. Hate is the root of the unwholesome. Delusion is the root of the unwholesome. And of course, the roots of the wholesome: non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. Now, we already discussed, I think, in the first session a little bit about this kind of use of the negative form there, so I won't go into that again. But I just wanted to look at the structure, and this relates to a little bit what we talked about earlier with the nature of karma and where karma comes from, okay? So notice that the 10 things, right, are called the 10 kammapatta, right, the 10 ways of karma, of our action. And these are the roots of that. So there's clearly a distinction between the karma and the roots of the karma, right? And the roots... This distinction is made persistently, and very, very consistently, and very, very nicely, and very, very precisely, right throughout the different teachings in Buddhism. You find it phrased similarly in dependent origination and a lot of other contexts. So the idea here is that there are certain underlying movements and forces, okay, which is, you can think of it as perhaps something like where you're coming from. Okay, the karma is where you choose to go to. Yeah, that's one way of thinking about it. So the wholesome or unwholesome roots will condition our behavior, and they will condition our karma and so on, but they don't determine it. Okay, so there's a difference between something being conditioned and something being determined, right? It means it's not 100%. Okay, so this is why we can sometimes feel greed and then say, oh, yes, I'll take an extra plate of ice cream, and then you don't, okay? And that's your choice, yeah? Sometimes you can feel anger, I'm going to yell at that person, and then sometimes you do, and then sometimes you don't. So you can have sometimes feel those things. Sometimes you can feel them very strongly, right? They can be very powerful forces. And yet, with the power of wisdom, the power of mindfulness, the power of restraint, then you can choose not to act out on them. And by not acting out on them, you're not making karma based on them. In fact, you're making the opposite. You're making good karma, very powerful good karma, by restraining those forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. So the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion are not themselves karma, but they are forces that tend to condition karma in certain ways. Yeah? But we can intervene and change that. Yeah? So this is like if we analyze in Buddhism simply, we have like cause and effect, right? And so we have this like in the Four Noble Truths. So you have the suffering and the origin of suffering, right? So the cause and the effect. But this is a slightly more detailed analysis where the cause is now drawn into two stages, yeah? And so the cause of suffering is now two stages. One is the deep level cause is greed, hatred, and delusion. And then the more proximate or near cause is the particular actions we do based on greed, hatred, and delusion, or the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. And that's our karma. And so it's the karma which, of course, drives us into future rebirth. Yeah? So it's the choices we make based on greed, hatred, and delusion that drives samsara and drives rebirth. And we'll be talking more about that later when we talk about the factors of dependent origination as found in the sutta. One other thing I just wanted to mention here, it goes on in the next paragraph, paragraph 8 in Venerable Bodhi's edition, when a noble disciple has thus understood the unwholesome and the root of the unwholesome, the wholesome and the root of the wholesome, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust, he abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion, and he extirpates the underlying tendency, extirpates presumably meaning the same as abolishes or something, I'm not entirely sure, but anyway, the underlying view, tendency to the view and conceit, I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Now, that passage is somewhat problematic. The problem is kind of referred to in passing in Venerable Bodhi's footnotes, but he doesn't really discuss it. The problem being that the whole middle portion of the passage sounds like you become an arahant, right? Whereas at the end, it sounds like becoming a stream enterer. Okay, so we're talking about a noble disciple of right view, whose view is straight, has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, has arrived at this true Dhamma. These are all phrases used for the Sotapanna or the stream enterer. Whereas abolishing underlying tendencies, abandoning ignorance and so on is always the arahant. So when we encounter problems like this in the text, now then of course we have to do what we just said and bring our inquiring mind to it, right? Now, one of the things which we've often had as a kind of one of the tendencies that I often see in when people read the suttas like this is that they will try to explain the problems away. Okay, so you find what appears to be contradictions, and you assume, you bring the assumption that there cannot be contradictions because this is what the Buddha said, and therefore you make some explanation that makes it go away. And unfortunately, what that does is that that immediately says, I'm not actually going to listen to what the text is saying because I know better than the text does. Right? And I'm going to make this problem go away because you think that you're actually being respectful of the text, whereas in fact you're refusing to listen to what it says. Yeah? So if we're going to take the inquiring approach, first thing we do, we take an inquiring approach, is when there's a difficulty, is we say, well, let's gather all the facts that we can. Okay, so we gather all the facts and then we put it on the table and say, what is there? Now, in this case, the facts are expanded by taking into account the various versions of this sutta that we find in mostly in Chinese translation. Now, we're not in this session, we're having enough content to just discuss the Pali text, so we're not discussing in detail the Chinese text. And in fact, in almost every detail, the Chinese texts are pretty much the same as the Pali anyway. There's very few significant differences. But one significant difference is that the Chinese texts lack that passage about the arahant in the middle there. Okay, that's just missing. And so it just treats it much more consistently and simply as if you're becoming a stream enterer. So how do we interpret this? Well, there could be a number of interpretations and ways of looking at it, but it seems to me the simplest and most obvious way to interpret this is that the original text probably didn't mention about the arahant here. That's the simplest and most consistent reading, and that somehow an extra couple of lines, a couple of sentences found their way into the Pali, perhaps by a redactor's mistake. It might have been a recitation mistake, or sometimes it's a copyist's error, or something like that, or sometimes perhaps an editor doesn't notice that the mistake's gone in there. And so occasionally you find these little mistakes coming into the tradition. Not all that often, but occasionally you find that. So my own interpretation, the simplest interpretation is that it's just an editor's mistake. Of course, there could be something else to it as well. Next section on ahara, nutriment. So the Bhikkhu Bodhi's chosen to give a somewhat more technical nuance to the translation here. In fact, ahara is just an ordinary word that's used in Pali to mean food. Okay? So, but the literal meaning of ahara is har is to bear or carry something, and ah has a meaning of inwards, right? So literally it means intake. Yeah, it's a very literal rendering. So intake. And so by translating as nutriment, Bhikkhu Bodhi has tried to preserve a single translation which would encompass some of the more technical and philosophical uses which we'll find used throughout the suttas as well. So anyway, let's just read the section first and then we can have a bit of discussion about it. Okay, so after ending the previous section, the monks replied to Venerable Sariputta saying, good friend, Avuso. The bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced at the Venerable Sariputta's words. And then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When friends, so this is kind of a phenomenon which is well known to those of us who spend time teaching Dhamma, is that some people never want to hear a word of Dhamma in their life, and some people keep on wanting to hear more words of Dhamma. And so sometimes people are really interested and really hungry for the Dhamma, so they've heard one presentation, that's good, but they want to hear more. So here we go, more. When, friends, a noble disciple understands nutriment, ahara, or food, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is nutriment? What is the origin of nutriment? What is the cessation of nutriment? What is the way leading to the cessation of nutriment? There are four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be and for the support of those about to come to be. What for? They are physical food as nutriment, gross or subtle, contact as the second, mental volition as the third, and consciousness as the fourth. With the arising of craving, there is the arising of nutriment. With the cessation of craving, there is the cessation of nutriment. The way leading to the cessation of nutriment is just this noble eightfold path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. When a noble disciple has thus understood nutriment, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to greed. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. So here, while the external framework of the passage is similar to that we found previously, one difference we find with the format is it's introduced explicitly in the using the framework of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so but rather than dukkha and the origin of dukkha, so and so on, it uses ahara and the origin of ahara, and that framework is something that we'll find throughout the rest of the sutta. Yeah, so it's only the first passage which doesn't use that, the one on the pathways, wholesome and unwholesome pathways. All the rest of them, then we have this idea of the origin and ending and so on in the framework of the Four Noble Truths. And so this particular one is dealing with the topic of nutriment. Now, nutriment essentially means, in the basic meaning of it in the Pali text, is something which is a support or the condition for something else. Okay, so it's actually very closely related to teachings on dependent origination. And in fact, most of the teachings on the aharas, on the four kinds of foods, are found in the chapter on dependent origination in the Samyutta Nikaya, that's the Nidana Samyutta. And so basically, it's another way of looking at the idea of dependent origination. And so the Buddha is, as the Buddha would always do, is to start with something concrete and real, right? Very easy to understand, food. Right, we're dependent on food. Everybody kind of knows that, yeah? And there's one famous series of questions called the Novice's Questions or the Boy's Questions, where it says, it has a series of 10 questions. The first one is, what is the one? Second question, what is the two? And so on, and you have to be able to answer them. So what is the one? The answer to that question, sabbe sata ahara pitika, which means all beings, well, basically means everyone has to eat. Right, all beings subsist on nutriment, literally, but everyone has to eat. Yeah, that's the one thing. So as long as we are here in samsara, right, as long as we keep getting reborn, we're going to have to eat. Right, and you look at, you know, even the most basic single-celled organism, right, the first function that a single-celled organism has to do is to be able to eat, right, to be able to absorb something from the environment and get rid of waste. Yeah, and that's the number one thing they have to be able to do. So as long as we're getting reborn, we have to be dependent. And being dependent means a lot of suffering, right? Because, well, we all like to eat, right? But then there's a lot of dukkha around that whole thing, isn't it? Because then you like to eat and you eat too much, right? And then you get fat, and then you like to eat the wrong kinds of things, and then you get cancer, and then so on and so forth. And then you want to go to a nice restaurant, but then it costs a lot of money. And then when you eat, then you have to go to the toilet, and nobody likes going to the toilet. And then you have to do the washing up, and nobody likes doing the washing up, and so on and so forth. So there's all this kind of dukkha, which is revolved around the process of eating. And of course, we don't normally really think of that as part of our spiritual practice, do we, right? We food is food, right? You go and you might listen to a Dhamma talk or something, and then afterwards you go and have a meal. And you don't think of the meal as being an extension of the Dhamma practice, but of course it is. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha says, you know, mindful while you're eating, mindful while you're drinking, and so on. Also mindful when you go into the toilet. Right? And as far as I know, Buddhism is the only religion that gives explicit instructions on what to do when you go to the toilet. Right? These are all within our spiritual practice. Right? We can't be separated from this. And not only, you know, when we think of that, we say we're dependent on food, we tend to think of that in terms of something very immediate, right? You put a meal in the oven or something like that and you eat it, right? But actually, it's an extremely long and complex and interdependent web of conditions which we are dependent on every time we eat a single morsel, right? How does the food get on the plate? How does it get heated, right? Energy comes from somewhere. It's come from the fridge. Who made the fridge? Who provided the energy to keep the fridge cold? Who bought the thing? Who made the packaging? Who was the guy who drove the truck that brought it from the factory to the supermarket, right? Who was the person who filled our petrol tanks so that we could go to the supermarket and buy them and bring it back? Yeah, all of these people we're dependent on. Every single person who contributed to the car or the vehicle that you're driving, the designer of the gear shift stick in the car, right, has helped to contribute to your getting that food, right? Then in a more direct sense, of course, we think of the preparation, the processing the food's undergone, the packaging, all of that stuff. But it's not just the packaging, right? And there's the designer of the packaging, the manufacturer of the packaging. You've got to drill the oil to make the plastic to make the packaging. So all of those people, right? Then all of the people who are affected by the carbon emissions of the oil which is drilled in order to provide the plastic packaging for your thing, and then of course all the way back to the soil, right, or the sea if you're eating seafood or fish or seaweed or something, it's in the sea, otherwise it's in the soil, it grows there, the farmer, the all the people working on the farm, all the people who've manufactured the fertilizer, manufactured the weed killer, who've manufactured the barbed wire fences, and all of those, everything you see on the farm, everything like that you're dependent on. Every bite that you take.